Hello, and welcome to Sounding Out with Izzy, the podcast where we have conversations with musicians, music producers, publicists, live promoters, zine makers, journalists, and more about their experiences working in the music industry as women, non-binary, and queer people. I'm your host, Isabel Korp, the founder of the queer femme music-based blog and YouTube channel, A Girl's Two Sound Sense. For today's episode, I had the pleasure of chatting with Ale Campos and Emily Milgram from the Florida garage punk duo Las Nubes. I had a blast catching up with Ale and Emily and discussing a range of topics, including their love of the Powerpuff Girls, Diablo Cody, collaborating with the one and only Iggy Pop, and the method of the madness that went into the making of their new album, Tormentos Malsanas, which is coming out June 19th. And without further ado, let's get right into this episode.
Wait, where's my video? Awesome. And does it sound? Am I making a sound? Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes.
Hell yeah. Wow. You got like a microphone and shit.
You're pro.
Pro-ish. Just like, this is what the professionals do. Like, right?
Sure. Yeah. I wouldn't know.
Oh. Well, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Of course. Where are you at right now? Are you at your rehearsal headquarters or just at home?
Oh, this is my apartment.
apartment
in Miami, Florida. Yeah, it's a mess right now.
Yeah, by the way, can you hear like people talking from a distance at all on my end?
No, can you hear people talking from a distance on our end?
No. Okay, good. Because I have background noise suppression on high because I'm staying with my parents this week. And my mom like projects a lot when she's just talking or like really passionate about the conversation she's having. So it's just like, so I'm just like, oh no, mom, I have a meeting.
We're from Miami. We understand that.
My partner actually is the same way. He projects a lot.
Mine as well.
When he talks. So mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a like the Latina thing.
Yeah.
Well, to start out, would you each like to introduce yourselves and what you do?
I'm Ale. My name is Ale Campos. I play guitar and I sing in the band.
I'm Emily Milgram, if you need my whole name. And I play drums and percussion in the band. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, I'm so excited to have you on here. And so to start off, you guys are based in Miami, Florida, which I imagine can be at times chaotic, tempestuous, and also exciting state to create art in. Would you tell me a little about your personal experiences living in Florida and what the artistic pockets in Miami that you're immersed in personally are like?
Well, Emily and I both, well, Emily co-owned a record store that I worked in as well. So we were kind of like deep in the music scene here. And I mean, I've been playing in bands since I was 17 years old. It's funny because for us, like the music scene, it has a lot going on and there's like a lot of amazing bands and it's just really great. But when you talk to an outsider or someone that just isn't involved in any music scene, they're just like, where is it? How do we find music? How do we find live bands and stuff like that? So it can be a little frustrating at times being a band down here, but at the same time, it's kind of awesome. And we have a lot of really talented musicians that come out of here.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Miami and I've been into music my whole life. I'm 41 now. So it's been a long life of liking music. And I used to go to a lot of shows when I was a teenager, young adult. I didn't really play in bands here until I moved back here after living in Oregon for a while. So I moved back when I was closer to my 30s. And I had actually, while I was out there, I started a record label and I was doing a lot of auxiliary music stuff. I played in a couple bands, but it wasn't a big deal. And then I came back here and I started working the record store, Sweat Records. And I was like, ah, I'm done playing music. I'm never gonna play music again, whatever. And then someone kind of like pushed me into it again. And now here I am in my 40s, trying to make the being in a band thing happen. But I think that the situation that I'm in only really could have happened here in Miami. I think there's a lot more opportunity in terms of major cities for artists and musicians to do things here, because one of the things about Miami is there are a lot of great artists and musicians come from here, but they don't stay here and they don't try and make a thing and keep a thing going. And it's just, Miami's notorious for that. And it's like, artists are like that, musicians are like that, venues are like that, movements are like that. Like people don't stay here, and then it just keeps, you know, turning over and turning over. And I feel like the people who actually do stay and do keep pushing for the things that they want, they can actually have some success with those things. So I'm still here doing it.
Same.
Yeah, interesting. You mentioned that you were pushed back into music by somebody. Why do you feel like, after feeling like you were ready to sort of leave it behind, why do you think that point in your life specifically was the right time to get you back into it?
I didn't necessarily leave music behind in the sense of I was still working at a record store and still super into music and still going to shows and still doing stuff, but I had kind of, I don't know, I just didn't feel really motivated or confident in playing or performing or doing anything, because I had been away from Miami for so long, and I came back to all these bands and all these musicians and all these people and all these things, and I was like, whoa, I don't think this is right for me right now. And I was at a party, and it was a show, it was like a house show, party, whatever, and there were drums there, and I was really drunk, and I was like, I can play the drums, you know. And I was like, got on the drums, and my friend Betty was like, dude, you don't suck. You can play drums. I was like, cool, thanks. And she was like, you should play drums more. And I was like, yeah, no, I gave that up. And short version, she had an extra drum kit, lent it to me. And I think I started playing in a local band like 2 weeks after that. And then, yeah, just been doing that since. So that would have been like 2012, maybe, that happened. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and so was the record store connection initially how y'all met each other?
We met through shows, I think.
Yeah, right? And we had gotten asked also by Mindy Abovitz to do the founder of Tom Tom Magazine. It's like a, I don't know if you know about it, but it's like a all-female
drum magazine,
right, yeah. And she's from here originally.
Yeah.
And so like, She's based in New York, but would come down here a lot to do activations and stuff like that. And she would ask us to do things and has featured us in the magazine a couple times. So we just like met through that, just, you know, being involved in the music scene together. And I would go into Sweat also, Sweat Records, the record store that Emily worked at.
And while we were doing that thing, that's when I think you got hired to work at Sweat.
Yes.
Like around that same time.
Yes.
So yeah.
But yeah, just music scene and record store.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And that's how I'm like, when I discuss how I met a lot of my friends who are musicians, it's usually just like, we can't even remember a distinct time when we met. It's just like, the scene, you know?
It happens.
So that makes sense. And I was wondering if with your Latin backgrounds, like, are there any specific musical traditions or cultural influences that have impacted your work?
I don't know, not really, just because at least my background is Cuban, Argentinian. I mean, I love Cuban music. I love Argentinian music, but like a lot of the folk music or traditional music from both don't really lend themselves to rock and roll as much. However, there are a lot of, I mean, rock music in Argentina is huge. And I feel like a lot of artists from the 60s and the 70s, I think kind of like influenced me into wanting to, you know, learn how to play guitar, because that's the music that my dad would listen to when I was a kid. Bands like Pescado Rabioso or Los Gatos, you know, stuff like that. I just really was influenced by, but I wouldn't really go as far as to call it like cultural or like traditional music, because it's very, very much rock influenced.
So I'm not from any Latin or Hispanic origin. I'm half white people, half mystery meat. I mean, I could be, maybe. I don't know where my dad's from. He's adopted and he never found out. So whatever, but that notwithstanding, growing up in Miami, I heard a lot of music that was not, you know, traditionally American music, and it was just sort of always there around. And I think it was rhythms and things that sort of crept into my subconscious and always sort of made sense to me because they were everywhere when I was growing up, you know, and my family hung out with a lot of people who were, you know, Cuban or Latin American as I was growing up. So that stuff was just always around. And I think that when I got sort of into my later 20s, and then definitely upon coming back here, I started to get more into a lot of those different types of music more seriously in terms of appreciation, but then also learning how to play certain styles. So learning how to play, you know, Afro-Cuban stuff, how to play salsa. Right now I play in a Brazilian group. I play in a bloco. It's kind of like a samba school, but whatever. So I'm learning to play and have been studying a lot of that stuff, different samba formations. We also play cumbia, like, so all these things that just kind of like, yeah, have always been there peripherally, but, you know, I finally put into my musical practice, you know, maybe in the past decade.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I also wanted to talk a little bit about the album that's coming out. And I wanted to ask more specifically about how everything you addressed on the project, things like the struggles of starting a family as a musician, COVID depression, getting older and fighting injustice in a productive way. How did the first seed of the album initially come about, and what did the process look like from conception to completion?
Long.
Yeah, it took forever.
A durational exercise.
Yeah, I would say the first song that I wrote that is on this album, I wrote it like 5 years ago.
You wrote it before the first album came out.
Yeah, I wrote it a minute ago. And like all the other songs kind of just came trickling in little by little over the years. But then it wasn't until quarantine that, you know, I had more time to sit down in my studio and just like play. And then that's really when I started just writing more and more and more and more and just coming up with more songs all the time. Like there were moments that I remember not being able to fall asleep, or I would wake up in the middle of the night because, you know, I was trying to come up with a vocal melody for a certain song and just was all day, you know, for a whole week trying to figure it out. And then I'd wake up in the middle of the night and be like, I got it. And I would just go into my studio at like 4 a.m. and my partner at the time would be like, are you okay? Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, I mean, I have nothing else to do. I don't have work right now. So might as well just wake up at 4 a.m. and, you know, figure this out. And so, yeah, like a lot of the songs were written around that time. And then shortly after, maybe a couple more were written. And then it took us like, what, 2 years to record it?
I mean, yeah, like proper, like including the demo time, including like the rehearsal time, the demo time, start to finish, mixing, yeah,
2 years.
about 2 years. So this thing should be going to preschool just about when it comes out. I don't know how we're gonna pay for that. Childcare is expensive.
Lol.
Yeah, when you're like you were talking about just like how that finally that idea finally came to you when you were like sort of asleep, when you are sort of hitting the those like creative blocks and running into a wall, do you feel like are you more of the type of creative to push through the noise and finally get to a solution, or do you stop playing music and then take a break and let it come to you naturally?
I guess I kind of do both. It really just depends on if I really, really, really want to finish a song, then I'll just kind of power through. I've spent entire days just sitting at my studio and just like recording demos or playing, just trying to figure out because I have it there, like the intention is there. I just don't know what it is that I want to do with it yet. And sometimes I can be so picky because I really want to try and make something that is somewhat different, even though I know it's like kind of almost impossible to make something unique and different nowadays, but I want to try to make it the like catchiest and the something that will like stick in people's heads, you know? So I kind of go with the what is it, the Stephen
See, I was just
Merritt,
gonna, yeah, I was gonna mention Stephen
the
Merritt
Stephen Merritt
when you were talking
route.
about the 4 in the morning thing. I was like, did you record it? Because Stephen Merritt would not approve.
Right, because exactly. So what I usually do is what Stephen Merritt of Magnetic Fields does is if it's catchy enough, I don't record it. And I wait till the next day to see if it's still stuck into my head. And if it's still stuck in my head, then it's
Then it's
catchy
good.
enough and it's
Yeah.
good and I'll use it. But if I forget it completely, then it wasn't meant to be and it's just, next.
I didn't know that was a method that Stephen Merritt used. I mean, and I'm not like the biggest magnetic fields like stan, like a good friend of mine is, and they went to see them the 2 nights that they did at King's Theater, where they played 69 love songs in full over a period of 2 nights. I honestly like it's a good if I had went there's it's a good thing there's seats in King's Theater because I could not stand for that long. Like that's why like I was with my mom last night and we were like let's watch the Eras Tour movie because we're bored and we have nothing to do. And it was that was exhausting. Just like it's 3.5 hours.
Oh, Jesus. Wow.
Like so, I couldn't imagine. So imagine like actually going and like watching 3 hours of
Right.
Taylor Swift doing her like super calculated performance. Like
That's a
that.
lot.
A lot of C and G chords, I bet.
Yeah.
3.5 hours.
Exactly. But I mean, a big thing that I took away from the album is how difficult it can often be to steer a ship that feels like you have no destination, which is a lot of what being a musician often is. So when addressing that type of uncertainty, what did you in turn discover about yourselves that you might not have discovered if you didn't really go there with your writing?
Yeah, I think it was definitely a way of navigating. I mean, a lot, some of the lyrics that I wrote were just like also dealing with current relationships that I like was in and just not happy in and dealing with that. But also, yeah, like as a band, I feel like it's been really hard on me. A lot, the whole social media thing. Emily's like really good about not giving a fuck about it, but
I give a fuck about other things that I probably shouldn't give a fuck about, though.
I get really, really, it kind of messes with my head sometimes that, like, how all these, you know, social media platforms are just driving us crazy and making us feel irrelevant. Like, Bethany Costantino from Best Coast has been just, like, putting it out there a lot that she's been feeling that way as well, and it has been resonating a lot with me that it's just frustrating that you spend all this time writing all this music, and, you know, it comes from, like, this really personal, vulnerable place to put it out there and for it to just fade into nothing like a week after it comes out, you know. And I think, like, a lot of the songs too that I've been writing, I kind of talk about that and dealing with that, and I've been trying to not give a fuck as much about it, but it's been, you know, it's a work in progress. I'm a work in progress.
Yeah, I kind of for a long time now have been informed by my own practice of valuing the emergent over the immediate, and kind of applying that to, I don't know, I just think a lot of things, like, yeah, for sure, you write these songs, you do these things, you put them out there, and then, like, you know, it's gone in a week, it doesn't matter, the release cycle is over, social media, like, chewed you up and shat you out. But then I think about, at least in experiences that I've had discovering music that has changed me in a positive way, or discovering a book, or, you know, an artwork or a film, and it's just like, this thing that someone created however many years ago and in whatever context is moving me right now. And I like to think that there's the potential for something that I create or collaborate on or put into the world being that thing for someone else, and that makes me feel better about the bullshit immediacy and how everything is cross marketing. It's about sunglasses or shoes.
Mm-hmm.
That was an Ani DeFranco lyric. But anyway, you know, just, yeah, I think that's something. Also, I approach the things that I'm not a songwriter, I'm a space filler, but I like to approach the way I fill space with that mentality. Like, it feels good. I enjoy making it. I enjoy being around the people I'm doing it with in any context. And that's what I'm getting out of it. It's what I want to be doing, and it makes me feel good. So,
and it's very important to focus on that. And also the fact that there are ways to get your word out there, even when it feels like unattainable to do if you're not posting all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And stuff like that. I remember a famous quote that Molly from Always said, she famously said that she would rather rot in obscurity than start a TikTok account.
Mm-hmm. And literally.
Yeah.
And to this day, she still hasn't. And they're still huge as ever. And they were nominated for a Grammy, their last album. So it's possible, and that's, like, reassuring to know, but it is also, like, it is very weird to be alive at this point in time and to be an artist where there's so much more talk about the business model and the marketing than the art.
Yeah, I have a friend that has a radio show on NTS, and she's, like, very much punk and plays punk music. And I remember one night I was talking to her and, like, sharing my feelings about all of this with her, and she was, like, agreeing with me on all of it. But then at one point she's like, you guys just need to start a TikTok. And I was like, no, not you too.
Like, we love you, but no. Yeah,
no. Respectfully, no.
No.
Hell no. Yeah, I stop at Instagram.
Well, and hey, who knows what happens with TikTok now with the bill that they just passed, and what's going to happen. And I mean, whatever. I don't even know why I spent my time reading that very long article about all of that this morning. But I like to stay informed. So all the TikTok talking might be for naught. We'll see. I've been working in the music industry proper since 2000. Oh my God, I've been working in the music industry for 20 years. Wow, that's fucked. I just realized that. So I've been working on the, you know, promotion and booking and record label side of things. I mean, I don't do booking or promotion or that stuff anymore, but I, point being, I was doing all that thing before, like, Facebook had just started, right? There was no streaming anything. Like, you still had to send, I remember doing radio campaigns for bands and mailing 1,000 copies of promo CDs, like addressing them all and sending them all and calling all the radio stations to ask about whatever. Like, people don't know how fucking easy they have it these days. Point being, like, that, what I was doing then, like almost 20 years ago, was very different than how people did it, had to do it 20 years before that. There were no cell phones, there was no internet, there was no, you know? So everything changes, and I think this is just, you know, this is just the paradigm that we're in now. And we don't know, I don't think we can say we know with any certainty where it's going to be 20 years from now either. You know, everything changes, and industries change along with those, you know, technological and communication paradigm shifts, and people figure out, you know, how to monetize it, how to make it work, all those other things. Yeah,
that is true. And yeah, who knows? Like, and eventually, like, when it comes to technology, whatever is prominent in, like, the zeitgeist and stuff like that, something always gets replaced eventually.
Yep. And people still buy vinyl, and people still buy tapes.
Exactly.
That's just, like, the funniest thing to me. Like, I love it. It's great. It's one of these things that's, like, a running joke. When we worked in the record store, and I work now one day a week in a bookstore that also happens to have records, but even with books, people will walk in there and it's like, they still make these things? Not so much the books, but people will be like, oh, they still make records? And it's like, yeah, oh, but no, these are all old ones. It's like, no, this is literally Taylor Swift that came out today. This is brand new. There was not Taylor Swift 30 years ago. This is not a vinyl record from 30 years ago. And people are just like, wait, huh? Like, something, like, you know, explodes in their head and they just, like, can't understand it. But then you have droves of people who want to buy all the vinyl and want to buy all the tapes. And yeah, so a lot of things change, but some things don't, in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like, vinyl never went away. There's so many people that I had to tell that to so many times in the record store. Like, oh, it's back. It never left. So
it, like, just got cheaper.
And then when vinyl left the mainstream music industry, all the punks kept it alive. Yep. All the DIY folks kept it alive. All the noise kids kept it alive. Like, I was putting out vinyl when, you know, the major, and even some of the major indies weren't. So, you know, it never went anywhere.
Yeah. It's like, you know, that song by Jeffrey Lewis where he sings about, like, how he's like, the CDs are so expensive, so I only buy LPs, and now the LPs are too expensive, so now I buy CDs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah.
Everything eventually, like, comes back around. Like, every, the 20-year cycle theory, it just yeah, continues. Yeah.
Hits will not come back, though. I promise you that.
I wish they would.
What won't come back?
Hit clips? Do you know what those are?
No, please tell me. Indulge me.
It's kind of like an MP3 player, but like a proto digital music player.
There, it's like, it has like this little, it's like this small, right? But it's emulating like a CD.
There's like a little cartridge.
But there's a cartridge that's like a little chip that you pop it in and it plays 30 seconds of whatever song it is.
Yeah, so you can baby. So you can, like, I was trying to say the chorus of Hit Me Baby One More Time. So you can basically get, like, yeah, like Britney Spears for 30 seconds, Christina Aguilera for 30 seconds. And you collect the little cartridges and the hit clip thing is like a keychain. And you can be like, oh, yeah, boom, I'm going to listen to my 30 seconds of NSYNC. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's not coming back.
Why
quote me on that.
Why only 30 seconds?
Because that's all that could fit on the chip.
Yeah.
Because because the storage didn't exist at that capacity yet to have this like compressed shitty audio.
This is what
God.
Yeah, look that shit up. It's funny. And the commercials are hilarious too.
Yeah, good stuff. You know, I mean, I don't know, because TikTok's thing is like, what, 15, 30 seconds? So maybe it will come back.
Yeah, but TikTok's thing is 15, 30 seconds, but there's visual.
Okay, we're sidetracking. We're sidetracking.
You can keep going. The clips you have to pick up, put it in, blah, 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 and like, whatever. Yeah. You're like, this podcast was supposed to be 5 minutes, you guys.
Yeah, that was a little before my time. Like the only clips I remember are the shuffle, the iPod shuffle. That pretend are barrettes. Yes. Clip them in your hair. But yeah, I also wanted to ask you about the secret, well, or not so secret, the open secret. It's literally in your press release, so it's not really secret at all. Connection between Woodby and the Powerpuff Girls.
Oh, so one day me and Emily were working at the record store, and I don't remember who brought it up that we heard a rumor that Diablo Cody was making a live action Powerpuff Girls but it was just like them as like grown up.
Yeah, live art, and it was gonna be a series.
It was gonna be a series on the CW.
That's right.
And it was basically just gonna revolve around them being grown ups and trying to deal with like
the trauma
yeah. of being a child superhero and not having a childhood, like a proper childhood, and just being forced to be superheroes as like young kids. So then I was like, wouldn't it be cool if we could write the theme song for this show, this, you know, would-be show? And that, I don't know if it was that same day or that week, it was just one of those days where I walked into my studio and I was like, I'm going to sit down and try and write this theme song. And I sat down for, I swear to God, like 20 minutes, and I wrote the whole thing. Like, it just came out. All of it. And I sent Emily a voice memo. Mm-hmm. I had even written a chorus, like a different chorus for it. And Emily was like, I love it. I don't think the chorus should be so like obvious or blatant, because I was trying to make it really like, you know, themed, Powerpuff Girls themed. I was like, yeah, you're right. I'll make it more vague. So I just left it with the verses. And ended, like, there's really not a chorus in that song, because it just goes, and I know the more I give, the less I'll get back.
The chorus,
and then it
just
comes
shredding.
Back around. It there's a key change, it goes up a half step, and then it comes back around and it repeats. But yeah, I did that in 20 minutes and then showed it to her, and it became a thing. And I mean, I don't know about, I think the show only did like
they shot a pilot.
A pilot episode, and then it didn't get.
Well, and then they wanted to reshoot the pilot because there was like, there was all sorts of sloppiness with it. Yeah.
And it just didn't end up happening. So I was like, well, maybe for the future, if it ever becomes a thing, we could send it to Diablo Cody and be like, look, we wrote you a song. Mm-hmm.
I was just going to say you should pitch it for Diablo Cody's next project if it seems apt enough for the story.
Hell yeah.
I mean, the song rips. It could kind of work wherever, you know, it's not.
Yeah.
And maybe now in hindsight, it's good that scrapped the chorus that was utterly specific.
Right.
Because now it can apply to anything. So many things.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't ever want to pull a Destiny's Child name dropping Charlie's Angels in your Charlie's Angels soundtrack song.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Okay, so my last question, because I couldn't avoid this, like I couldn't resist. The godfather of punk himself, Iggy Pop, called you far and away the hottest band in Miami and the most
Look at us.
And the most socially relevant. So now that you've like played with him before and gotten to meet him several times, like what about meeting him surprised you the most?
he has a really good memory.
Super good memory.
He remembers everything. And he's so nice.
We've even seen him with a shirt on.
Our shirt.
Yeah, but multiple shirts. Most people have not ever seen him with a shirt on.
He's really, really sweet. A very kind, sweet soul. Like, he's the best.
Yeah.
He's awesome. He's my boss because I play guitar in his band. And he's just, every time he shows up for rehearsal, it's like a good time. And he always comes up to me and is like, hey, how are you doing? How's the band? Like, I don't know. He's just like a grandpa, you know, just asking how everything is and wants to know how everyone's doing. He's great.
Yeah, and what's cool is he seems really good at keeping like up to date with like what's new and what is relevant that he thinks is worth hearing. Like he'll be like, I love Girl Pool and I also kind of like this Young Thug song. And I'm just like, oh wow.
That tracks.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's awesome, dude.
Yeah. I remember going to, I used to intern at Elsewhere in Bushwick, the venue, and Girl Pool played their final farewell show there before they disbanded. So miss them, rip. But yeah, like it was really cool of him to sort of put them on and play them on his BBC show. And he played y'all on his BBC show, didn't he?
Times, yeah.
Yeah, a few times recently too. And he, so I also sent him like a friend, some friends of ours from Mexico, and he played them on his show too. And they were so stoked about it. It was really sweet.
That's amazing. Well, Ale and Emily, thank you so much once again for joining me. I thoroughly enjoyed getting to know y'all a little and catching up. And I will let you know when this goes live. Thanks again.
Can't wait. It was nice to meet you and talk.
Thank you so much for listening to Sounding Out with Izzy. And thank you again to Ale and Emily for joining me today. Remember to subscribe and sign up for the mailing list on my YouTube channel and written blog, both under the name A Girl's Two Sound Sense. Give the podcast a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening, and I will catch you in the next episode of Sounding Out with Izzy.